Okay, so before we get started in our kind of topic today, do you guys have any questions about what you have due tomorrow at 5 p.m.? Okay. No questions. My kind of primary piece of advice, leave plenty of time to get your video uploaded. Okay. Don't wait until 4:50 to try to get it uploaded. It's going to take longer than that. Okay. That leaves you zero margin for error, effectively, if you're waiting that late. Okay. So start that process earlier in the day and be sure. Yeah.
I'm still thinking about how to word this, but is there anything that you want in the report that you don't want in the presentation?
So the question was, is the presentation an exact mirror of the report? I would say in many ways, yes. But you are going to have to be a bit more concise than you are in the report. So I think you have to focus more on getting to the main point and the most important points at each step along the way in the process. But yeah, the structure, the overall material you're showing and presenting pretty much mirrors the outline of the report. Do you have more?
So you posted example videos, I think it was from last semester, of teams that made this presentation.
So it should be example videos from, I think, the last three or four semesters.
Okay, well, one thing I was curious about, is there any way to tell which ones, you know, were actually good or not? That you, like,
short of watching them and developing your own opinion of that, no.
No.
Okay, so yeah, those are just all the videos that we got. I'll post you guys' videos too. All right, so you can look through those and try to get an aggregate of what people did well. But I would, you know, we have that video on technical presentations that you can review again. There's notes for that. There's a section in your book about technical presentations. So I think those are the resources I would lean on more heavily than the earlier classes, because they were learning the stuff at this, you know, just like you guys, effectively. Other questions? Okay, so a few other pieces of business then. A week from today, we are starting our mechatronics, electronics, and programming section of the class. Okay, so a week from today, that first day we're going to go through stuff. I don't want you guys to bring your boards. We're going to talk higher level, introduce you to the language, the way of thinking about this thing. I think my experience, if you guys have your boards in front of you for that part, you're not going to pay attention and learn that piece. And you're going to be lost for the rest of the 4 weeks we're working on this stuff. Okay. So a week from the day, we're going to introduce this stuff. You don't need to bring any of your kit until the following Tuesday. Okay. I'll send you guys some links. Between now and then, you need to get a few pieces of software installed that will allow us to program your boards. Link to those a few times in earlier presentations, but I'll make sure to send everybody the email. We have video steps how to get some of the stuff installed, the applications you need. They're all free. So costing you nothing, but I think it will. You do need to do that homework of getting that stuff installed. Okay. If you don't get installed before you come to class, a couple Tuesdays away, you're going to be trying to install that stuff. The rest of the class can't wait for you to install it. So you're going to be playing catch up, and it's going to be a lot easier to get lost at that point. So we want to make sure everyone has the stuff getting installed. You can bring laptops. If you don't have a laptop to bring, we can shuffle seats around and get you next to somebody that has one. Look over the shoulder if you want. Okay. But we will have examples on the board. We'll talk through. It's more important that you can understand the process and the examples we're walking through than to be typing along. Okay, that clear? You guys got it? Okay. Does anybody not have their kit yet? Is it on the way? You ordered? Okay. Cool. Okay, good deal. So in our kind of lecture portion of class today, we're going to talk primarily about design for safety. We're going to go very quickly through another section called design for X, where X could mean safety, could mean some other stuff. Okay. We're going to start, however, with this design for safety lecture. And the most important thing to think about when you're designing for safety is to realize that basically everything is dangerous, right? Everything's dangerous, right? So what you have to think about as an engineer is the danger inherent to this product proportional to the value it provides, right? And is it as safe as it could be and still provide that amount of value? Would making it safer decrease the value that it provides to the customer, right? And those are actually measures. If you are unlucky enough to find yourself in a court case where your design has hurt somebody pretty bad, that's going to be what they ask you. What did you do to make sure this is as safe as it possible? And could it be safer without sacrificing utility? Right. So we need to think about our design kind of in those terms. Right. And if we're thinking about it in those terms, we need to think about building the safety into the design itself. Okay. It's not something we can really tack on the end. Okay. So some design for safety phases. Problem definition, we can identify risk, estimate the likelihood of those risks, some evaluation, design review. So that should look pretty similar. It follows a very similar process to the design process itself. Right? And quite often, this ends up being kind of a sub-step in the design process. When you're evaluating concepts, you can go through a separate risk analysis for each one of those alternative concepts. And this would inform what number that scores in the house of quality as a result. Right? These are the point, in the evaluation matrix. Right? So the evaluation matrix, remember, as you develop more skill and experience as an engineer, those numbers in the evaluation matrix are not just from some kind of gut feeling that that number should be that. They should have some analysis backing them up. Right? So if you have some estimate of safety, which you probably will for most designs, some kind of customer requirements of safety, this would be the analysis backing up why one design scored better or worse than another. Right? It's not just your gut feeling that it's safer. You need support for it. So that's the process. So when we're thinking about, so this is kind of the analysis phase, we wanted to think about guiding principles, and so far we've talked about really designing in safety. Right? So safety is a part of the design process itself. You can utilize guards, anticipate operator errors, restrict improper use, accommodate unusual operating conditions, utilize redundancy, design safe failure modes, delay maintenance, and then add warning labels and systems. Right. So when we talk about designing in safety, what we're really saying is that this is not safety. Right. Engineers are not the people that put these on a device. Right. It's lawyers and law. It's lawyers. Right. Lawyers. FDA maybe had something to do with it, right? You can't rely on people reading these warning labels. How many of you guys actually read warning labels in general? A few, okay? Not many, right? So people just ignore these things. These are here to prevent your company from getting sued, hopefully. Or if you do get sued, give you something to fall back on, hey, that person didn't read the label, okay? This doesn't make your product safer. Right. It's your job as an engineer to make that safer, right? So you can't rely on warning labels, right? That's why you have to design the safety in the product. You have to make the product inherently safe, okay? You also can't rely on an operator having any kind of common sense, right, or any kind of special training to use your device, okay? And we want to think about maybe modifying the design to make it safe, okay? So one example is a table saw, right? People lose fingers to these guys. I think it's thousands a day lose fingers to table saws, surprisingly. They're pretty dangerous. So some of you have probably seen this product, okay? So let's take a look. Okay, so that was a good example, or is a good example, of designing safety into the product, right? It's not just slapping a warning label. Probably has warning labels too, right? The safety is a distinctive factor of that design even, right? And that's a selling point of that design, right? So the safety is not just a safer table saw design. That actually is their market, right, for making things safer. From a market perspective, another thing that kind of saw can do is if you're able to introduce, by including safety in your entire design process, kind of a step change in the safety of some device without inhibiting its quality, those 10 things end up being regulated into any product that has to do that, right? So it can be a quite lucrative market if you're able to design a product that's fundamentally safer than any that came before it, you end up being part of the rules, effectively, right? And everyone has to buy that design from you. Quick aside, you get most of you guys in Dynamics right now? Good number of you? So he said it's spinning at whatever RPM, and he threw out something like 1,000 Gs, right? So it's spinning at 1,000 RPMs, and it has to stop in a certain amount of time. How could you get the actual acceleration there? Have you guys gotten to impulse momentum yet? Next week? Okay. So impulse momentum will get you there. The forces that are required to stop it. So he's using G's actually as a measure of force, which is not quite right, but kind of in the ballpark. So you know the rotating speed, you know how long you have to stop in terms of time or distance. You can back out what force was necessary to stop something in that amount of time. That's effectively impulse momentum. So now you have something to think about when Dr. Hibbler teaches you impulse momentum. Okay, so here's another example of designing in or failing to design in safety in this case. So this truck actually has an aerial lift. So the idea, you might call it a bucket truck or a cherry picker. Some workers go up in the bucket, goes up and works on something high. So this particular one was working on an antenna on the tail of a airplane at Miami Airport. And the two guys were up in the back of this guy and went out to, I think they were actually changing the antenna on the tail of the plane. And as they went up, this aerial lift just kind of flipped over on them. And what had happened is that, of course, one guy thought the other put the extension legs out and vice versa, right? So both thought the other had done it. Neither one had actually put out these stabilizing legs. Okay. This truck was a retrofit, I think, in 1978 or 77. And then 1 year later, the rules changed on these designs, right? Where kind of safety, innovation changed the rules, right? So if this truck had been made 1 year later, it would have been impossible, or the system should have had a system, this truck should have had a system in place to where you're actually not actually able to go up into the bucket until these legs are extended a certain distance out. Right? So you can't trust your operator to do the safe thing, right? Whether they're doing it, as we'll see, kind of unintentionally, or if they're doing it intentionally. So really simple design change, right? You have a switch out here. If this thing is not extended out to trigger that switch, or you have some measure of this distance, it's pretty easy to get for this system. If you don't see that, that bucket's not going up, right? And that's a trivial extension to this original design, right? If you design an aerial lift that worked that way, and someone gets badly injured, they are coming after you, and they're going to win, right? It's a trivial extension. It doesn't decrease the utility of this design. Right? It's up to you to design that safety in. Okay? So for example, you see a lot of modern lifts actually are designed in a way, so these, it's a JLG, is actually designed so that it actually is completely stable no matter where it goes in its workspace. Completely stable all over. I worked another aerial lift. It was an accident case up in Boston. So they were some guys were up in a lift like this. Actually 180 feet, working on the edge of a building. In their aerial lift, they started to back away from the building, and they flipped over backwards. Fortunately, one of the guys died, actually. So as an engineer, you design that system, right? You don't want to be responsible for that. You want to be responsible for that person living, right? Your safety saved that person's life. So what happened in that case is actually the system had checks, right? Had checks all along to make sure that you could get into an unstable configuration, but had information about the system to make sure it stayed stable. It wouldn't let you go there. However, if any of those sensors returned to fault, it stopped checking all of them and allowed you to keep moving. So what happened in this particular case, the lowest sensor actually had a fault. Their code was not written in a way so that it notified the user or just stopped operation, which would be the right thing to do there. And as a result, somebody died. Right? We have that responsibility to make sure things like that don't happen. Okay? Second principle, we can utilize guards, right? So you look, compare kind of old style, real mowers, right, to a modern lawnmower, and basically there's guards everywhere. It's much harder to get to the dangerous part of a modern push mower than it is to those old school manual ones. Okay. Can you still do it? Yes, of course. We'll talk more about that in a second. But you're protecting your user. You're making your user have to intentionally misuse your device to injure themselves. And that's the place you want to be pushing towards. And of course, we saw kind of the leading way to make table saws safer for a long time, which is put guards on them. Okay. You also have to anticipate operator error. Right? So those guys in the Miami airport, they didn't intentionally, at least based on their testimony, didn't intentionally not put the legs out. They made a mistake. They each thought the other person had done it. Right? So you have to think about not just how is my product going to be used in perfect conditions by a perfectly trained operator when I have their full attention. You have to think about all the foreseeable cases and how your product's going to be used. Because people will make mistakes. Right? People are going to be distracted. Right? People are going to be tired. Right? They're not going to read the operator's manual. Right? They're not going to pay attention during or remember training. Right? Equipment's not going to be maintained properly. These are all foreseeable things. Right? People are going to be drunk when they use your device. Just going to happen. Right? And are these things foreseeable in the context of the product you're designing? Right? The big benefit of thinking about these is not just increasing the safety of your product, but also thinking about how it might be operating in these ways. Generally, you can just make it better in general. So you see this in kind of computer systems, right? Computer systems that are accessible for people that are blind or deaf are actually a lot easier for us to use, kind of people that are able to speak and hear, right? And see, okay? So if you're thinking about kind of edge use cases, it's going to make your use case for everyone much better, okay? So kind of a funny example of this guy will test out your web application. We'll get drunk and then test it out. So, charges money to do it, apparently. Okay, people will be sleepy and tired, right? So here's a Boeing factory in Seattle, right? Or just north of Seattle in Everett, Washington. For a long time, it was the largest building in the world by volume. And basically, more or less, you can get a crane to almost the entire floor of this building. You can drive a crane from one corner all the way to the other, based on the system they have abovehead. Right? And you see here, this is, it looks like a 767 maybe. 737's on the right side, I think. But big passenger jets in this building, three or four deep in production. So if you're driving the crane, and actually these are cranes where the operator will actually ride overhead. So you climb up in the rafters, basically hop into this crane, and as you're driving the crane around, you're riding along with it. Right? And you have to kind of look between your legs. It's kind of fun to drive, actually. Look between your legs, and you get signals from the ground, and they tell you where to move the thing around. Right? So we were working at Boeing, and they told us a story that one of these crane operators picked up a part at one side of the kind of column and had to deliver it all the way to the other side. Right? So he's riding, picks up the part. It's all attached by the people on the ground. And he's driving this crane. It takes a long time to get that far. His cranes are not so fast. Hand on the throttle, the joystick moving forward. Falls asleep on the way. So he slams the crane and this multi-million dollar part right into the end of the building. Okay. So yeah, that user shouldn't have fallen asleep, right? And I would guess he probably doesn't have a job anymore. But also, you can maybe foresee that in some circumstances, some operator might make an error and cause that crane to run into the end of the building. So they could have done something in the crane design itself to make that crane operation safer, right? The crane had no idea where it was at along its path. There's no switches or limits at the end stopping the crane before it slams just into a physical stop. So it's actually part of the work we did at Boeing. We did it at St. Louis, not in Seattle, or not at Everett, but basically put in sensors to let the crane know how far it was from its end stop and its position in space. And by doing so, it made that crane safer. And actually, in that case, enhanced its utility because we can do a lot of other things if we know where the crane is at. So we can design safety into these crane systems, anticipate a user falling asleep or making mistakes that might cause that crane damage or damage to the parts the crane's carrying. Right. Another big crane accident. Cranes have all kinds of accidents. They're great videos if you want to spend some time on YouTube. Here's one. Let me turn the volume down on this one. So these guys in this crane are trying to pick up this guy, drop it down into this hole, basically. So modern cranes, this has been a kind of older video, and better cranes have some sense of the load they're under and won't let you continue to do stuff like this. Right. So he has this, his load, and actually he's lowering the boom. You guys in Dynamics, what's happening there? Right? So he's lowering his boom. That moment about the tipping point of that crane is changing, getting longer effectively. So, nice little build up here. You can guess what's going to happen. There we go. So yeah, that operator, strictly speaking, is probably using that crane outside of its intended operational parameters. But as an engineer, is that something you could have foresaw happening? Yes, you guys all foresaw it happening sitting right here. Right? So we can add sensors, and those kind of sensors that were necessary to prevent something like this are not that expensive relative to the price of this kind of crane. Okay? So we can sense our load, and we can make the crane, we can design that safety into the system. Right? Anticipate improper use. Okay? We can restrict improper use, right? So don't let your customer mess up. That's kind of what we were just talking about, right? So all kind of modern push mowers have one of these lever thingies on the end, right, that you have to hold down in order for it to go, right? So what do you guys do with that? You guys are using push mowers. What do you do with that handle? You hold it. Some tape around it, I heard somebody. Zip tie around it, right? So you're trying to help your user out, but that kind of device can be defeated, right? So you can zip tie that thing together and then pick up your lawnmower and trim your hedges with it or whatever you want to do, right? So people are going to do crazy stuff with your designs. And yeah, there is some limit to what you can anticipate and account for without affecting your utility, but you need to think about the cases pushing up to that limit, right? It's going to make your designs better, okay? So for example, we have, I showed you guys that boat projects we have. All our, kind of that lawnmower is an example of what's called a dead man switch. You have to hold it down in order for the thing to work. Right? It's kind of common in robotic systems, common in a lot of systems. So for us, for that boat, we actually have to hold down an extra button on the remote at all times for our commands to be sent, to be issued to the actual boat. Why do we want to do that for this kind of system? Might start driving into a person in a lake. Well, I could do that, yeah, if I'm holding the button down or not, I guess. Yeah, so say, you know, these joysticks are not so long. We have some that have longer joysticks. I drop my joystick. It lands upside down and it's pushing forward on the throttle. And it's sending that command to the boat that I'm not on anymore. All right. So we have these kind of safety switches. You guys that are boaters probably have a kill switch tied into your life jacket. We're supposed to, right? So kind of a similar idea, right? If I'm not here, right, if that switch is not closed, then I'm killing everything, right? So we did it by buttons. We did it virtually with the iPhone, right? So from your book, basically what we've been saying the whole time is you want to make it hard for your user, as hard as possible without reducing the utility of your design, to hurt themselves, to operate your device in an unsafe manner. Okay. So we kind of talked through that already. Another point is you utilize redundancy, right? So we have multiple tires on the rear axles of a tractor-trailer type truck. A single blowout doesn't kill this thing anymore, right? The switches on that aerial lift, right? You can have multiple checks, multiple sensors on the aerial lift so that when one fails, you start checking the others, right? You want to avoid single point of failures. You want to also design in safe failure modes. Anybody been on a Segway? Pretty fun, right? They are fine. One of the worst products in history, actually. They've lost money their entire existence as a company. Millions and millions of dollars every year they lose. They sell about 10,000 a year only. Right? So, it's a variety of reasons, but as a product, as an engineering thing, it's pretty cool, right? But they're not safe. It's not a safe product. One of the primary reasons is it has to be active and working perfectly to stay upright, right? It's an inverted pendulum. Anything goes wrong in a Segway, it's falling over, and you're falling over with it, right? So there's tons and tons of accidents every year on Segways. People break hips. People have worked on cases with broken skulls, broken necks, actually lower leg fractures, which we'll see, are actually another big problem in the Segway.
Wasn't the owner actually died off of one of these?
So yeah, it was not Dean Kamen, but the guy that had bought the company. It was riding a Segway off-road. It seems like, from what I've seen of it at least, that one of his wheels started spinning, much like this case here. So he hit some kind of sandy patch. That wheel loses traction, but it needs that wheel to have traction to be able to balance you, right? So you have some wheel that loses traction. One, now you have unequal forces on the two sides, right? You have a force on this side and none on the other, so you're going to spin, right? And it's not going to stay upright anymore. You're going to get tossed off of it, like this. And it seems like maybe that's kind of what happened to him, is he basically, yeah, right, so lost traction, tried to steer to correct, and ended up kind of driving off the cliff. Yep. The other big accident, like I mentioned, kind of these twist failures. You notice these most recent ones have this kind of big hump in the middle. And then, of course, you have this wide, big wheel you have to get on. So that's actually kind of difficult to get out of when things start going wrong, particularly when you're rotating. Right. So you have a lot of people that end up with spiral fractures of the fibula and tibia. Right, so just your foot gets stuck and the Segway keeps turning. It sounds pretty painful to me. So a cool engineering thing, but by no means a safe product. You also want to facilitate maintenance. Maintenance of your product is needed. You need to take care to make it easy to do. Otherwise, people are not going to do it. And a good majority of people are not going to do it anyway, even if it is really easy. Right? So old cars, one reason they were easy to work on is because they had to be worked on all the time. They broke down a lot, right? Look at modern cars are much more reliable. Certainly they're more advanced and electronic, but they're not really designed to work on in the same way, right? Design has changed a bit. Look at old computers, they're similar, right? Certainly you had, as this was at least partly due to upgradability, but things broke down all the time, and circuits broke, things upgraded, you had changed out. But now it's inside of the MacBook, that whole computer is just this board, right? The rest of it is battery. Right? It's not designed to have to work on it and repair it. Okay. Finally, last step of the whole process is to add the necessary warning labels. Right? You're working at a company, they're going to have lawyers telling you what needs to be on the thing, basically. Right? But you might have warnings that are actually part of your design. So here's an image of a cockpit. There's certainly tons of warnings in here that are meant to actually catch the attention of a skilled and trained operator. Right. But that is the kind of last fallback for any product to have those warning labels. Right. So you want to do everything we talked about, design safety into the product, and then the warning labels are still going to get added whether you want them to or not, basically. Questions about design for safety? Sure, certainly. We've kind of framed what we've talked about so far in terms of safety of the operator, but you need to think about safety of the operator, person actually using it, safety of the device itself, safety of people near the operator, right? Safety of the environment around the operator. So there's a lot to consider. You know, just like when we talk about customers and what it means to have a customer, you're going to have many customers. Each of those customers might have a different definition of what safety means to them in respect to your product. So you need to think about each kind of customer you have with respect to safety as well. Other questions? Okay. I'm going to show you guys quickly. Design for X. We're going to run through this really quickly. Right? I think this one's one that's better. You guys can just look at the slides, check it out. Kind of some review. Basically, the design for X is kind of how can a design be either improved or designed for X, where X is some value, right? So X could be manufacture, could be assembly, right? Could be ease of use, ergonomics, those kind of things, right? So the point is that we want to think about those X things in the phase of design you guys are working on in this class, right? If you get down to doing the detailed design of your concept or the production specification of your concept and then start thinking about, well, how are we going to make this thing? Or you get down to this step where you're starting to get to speccing out to manufacture what your product needs to be, well, how are we going to source the parts for this thing? Or you get down to here and then you start thinking about the safety. Right? This is too late in the process. Right? The whole idea here is to think about those things, and hopefully you're doing that as part of identifying what your customer is demanding early in the process. Okay. There's kind of some background on a kind of formalized process that we'll skip through. I want you guys, with respect to the lab we're going to be doing on Tuesday, to take a walk through prior to Tuesday, this number of slides. There's looks like slide 14 in this deck. So we start talking about design for assembly, right? Ways to make automated assembly easy, ways to make assembly cheap and affordable. Okay, so self-alignment is one, right? Different ways to do that, kind of nesting parts, using features for orientation, symmetry. There's a list of these things here in this presentation. These are all going to show up in the lab on Tuesday. Okay. So I'm going to let you guys take a peek at that. It's a little bit boring for me to just talk through it when you can just see it. All right. So, on Tuesday, we're going to do mini project 3. Okay. It's pretty cool. It's mechanical dissection. Probably also want to take a look at mini project 3 on the class website. It's already posted. There's a series of steps we're going to have to follow. If you've taken a look at that beforehand, you'll be way ahead of the game when you come in and can knock the lab out and get out of here quickly, probably. Questions about any of that? Thought of any questions about what you have to do tomorrow in the time I've been talking? All right, that's it for today.